This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thousands of people in Los Angeles County who cannot fully care for themselves rely on the help of home care workers. Home care workers who help with things like meal prep, bathing, the tasks of daily life. Now, to do their jobs well, those workers have to be close to their clients, breaking all the rules of social distancing. They're stuck in a tough dilemma. How do they protect themselves when their lives are tied to deep personal involvement with someone else? Pearl Gonzalez is one of two home care providers who serve a woman who has schizophrenia and only one kidney.
You know, I don't want to take the chance of me possibly being a carrier and taking it to my family because my son is also disabled. I would just die if that is because of me and bringing it home to them.
Gonzalez adds that the risk of going to work actually weighs just as heavy as staying home. Most of the home care providers make just enough to provide for themselves, and their clients may not survive without them. Here's KCRW's Jerome Campbell.
In a typical work week, Gonzalez and another home care provider divide up the work shifts. Gonzalez mostly works the day side. Then, 2 weeks ago, the other provider self-quarantined after exposure to the new coronavirus. Gonzalez is on her own, and she's afraid her client could have COVID-19.
We have no masks. We have no gloves. We have nothing to protect us. We cannot not work. So I really am freaking out about what's going to happen. You know, what is going to happen to my client? What is going to happen to me?
Gonzalez now covers both shifts, working late into the evening throughout the week. That's dozens of hours in close proximity to a person who may have come in contact with the virus. And the only barrier between them is the handkerchief over her mouth.
Does it make me feel safe? You know, and even the nurses at the hospitals and stuff, they have some equipment and they're catching it. So what's going to make me from getting, you know, what's going to keep me from getting it when I really don't have what I need?
Gonzalez says she went to Los Angeles County for more masks, but they didn't have any. All she received was a small bottle of hand sanitizer and a box of wipes. Her backup plan, she limits interactions where she can, including seeing her family. Her son and her father are staying with other relatives and Gonzalez is home alone. She says it's taking a toll on her mental health.
I spend a lot of time with them, as much free time as I can with them. And, you know, and especially my grandchildren, oh my gosh, you know, hugs and kisses and cuddles and watch TV and, you know, go places together. And I can't even do that right now. So I'm feeling very lost, very lonely, and just hard. It's all so hard because this is not something that I've ever experienced before.
Gonzalez contemplates whether it's all worth it some days. She makes less than $25 an hour, which she doesn't think is enough to risk her life. But then she thinks of the woman she cares for. That woman's family lives out of state and isn't able to provide the care that she needs. Gonzalez says she and her client are in this together. And for a time, they are all they've got.
Even if she does have it, and I'm doing everything that I possibly can, I could probably save her life. And that makes me try even more harder, because if I could save her life, then maybe I can save my own.
Mackenzie Bath is living out the reality Gonzalez is afraid of. She's sick and unable to work. She usually provides care for a 23-year-old man with autism. Right now, she's quarantined inside her home with the virus.
Now I'm legally mandated to not go into work anymore. Like, I don't have any source of income for 2 more weeks.
Bath is still on her parents' health care plan, but her finances are up in the air. She only earns 2 sick days a year. She's having to negotiate with her client's family for more.
Rent is going to be a struggle. If I can get one of these 2 weeks paid, then I think then I'll be okay. But if I have to go both weeks unpaid, I'm going to have some issues.
Her client's family is having some issues, too. They are also in quarantine and having to care for their son on their own. Judy Mark is the client's mother.
So my husband, who has a full-time legal practice and is supposed to be working, is instead, you know, going off of calls with his clients and running over and helping my son get in and out of the shower and making him lunch. And it's so incredibly stressful because not only are we not able to work because we have to care for our son, but we are also having to do this with gloves and masks on.
Mark says she can't wait for Beth to come back to work. She realizes that she couldn't get by without the help.
Just like we talk about the true heroes or those people in, you know, going to work every day in the hospital, the forgotten heroes here are these people who are coming in every day and supporting people with disabilities.
Carmen Roberts has been a home care provider for 15 years and wishes more people saw her work in the same way. Recently, Roberts and her cousin have been providing care for their 98-year-old aunt during the pandemic. Roberts says, right now it feels like helping people so personally can be too much to handle. Both clients and providers have to protect themselves from the coronavirus, which can put them at odds.
It's on your mind every day and on the mind of some of our clients, because some of the clients I've heard are not letting the home care providers in because they're afraid.
Robert says when the pandemic began, people rushed to the aid of healthcare workers, sending them masks and protective equipment. But she's needed the same materials too, but hasn't received support.
We aren't respected in the way a lot of careers are, but we are an essential part of this. We take care of, you know, our mothers, fathers, grandparents, children, of not only ours, but of other folk whose lives depend on us. So we're really on the front line.
Roberts adds that in recent weeks, she's been getting calls to care for a new group of clients, people with respiratory problems who are now recovering from COVID-19. For KCRW, I'm Jerome Campbell.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Last week, we kicked off a series of discussions, ones that we're going to be having over the coming weeks and months, looking at how LA can change, improve, after city officials eventually lift stay-at-home orders. A reimagining, if you will, of a city and region of many, many layers. Think of this time as a reset, right? You're working from home, you're traveling less, prioritizing different things, and the Los Angeles around you is manifesting into something that may very well be different going forward, for better or for worse. Francis Anderton has been talking to some folks about what a reimagined Los Angeles could look like in the coming months and years ahead, and she joins me now from KCRW's Design and Architecture Desk. Hi, Francis.
Hi, Steve.
And today we're going to talk about work, by the way. I guess the first thing is that you and I are doing this right now. We're working from home. We're both doing what's called telecommuting. Do you think that's what's going to come from all this in the end? A lot of people will no longer have to go to an office?
It's definitely a very powerful conversation that's taking place. Telecommuting has shown people that we can have cleaner air. People are very excited about that, but also that their lives have become, in some cases, not all, have become a little easier, less driving, less sitting in traffic for 2 hours. And LA has been a region that has been very tightly zoned. We've had areas for housing, areas for industrial, areas for commercial. That was already starting to somewhat loosen, but this is going to add impetus. Let's start with a man named Martin Leitner. He's an urban designer with the firm of Perkins and Will. They're designing, for example, Destination Crenshaw. He's currently sheltering in place at his home in Burbank. He's spending more time with his family, which he's loving. He's saving hours of driving. That time saved goes into working effectively. And he says that this is going to be hard for a lot of people to give up.
Right now, almost our entire lives are consolidating in what were residential neighborhoods. But based on what we're doing here today, I wonder if we can even continue to just call them residential neighborhoods. They're much more mixed use, maybe even blended use neighborhoods. And do we really want to, in a few months, when things are more normal than they are today, tell people that all of a sudden we can't do that anymore?
Well, are we going to tell people that?
It's really incredible how quickly we've adapted to a process of working that I think many of us were nervous of, didn't necessarily fully trust. And I'm definitely talking to people who are already thinking about how they might change the way the workplace works. So, for example, Tom Main, he's a very well-known architect in LA. He did the Caltrans headquarters in downtown Emerson College on Sunset Boulevard. He has an office in Culver City. He absolutely loves the camaraderie, the collaboration with his colleagues. But he said they're already talking about making a transition, having the quiet solo work on the computer take place at home if people want, and you'd come to the office for the collaboration.
We're already looking at the way we work in terms of the physical plant, and it will not be the same. It'll be some sort of a hybrid. And what will take place is going to be many more spaces that are designed for dialogue and communication, and many less spaces for a desk or a place you work in an isolated sense.
Now, Tom is someone who has an office and has a team. There is a conversation happening about how some companies might decide to not even lease office space. And certainly out there in the world of commercial real estate, there's conversations happening, some anxious conversations about what is going to happen to office space. Already there's conversations about how you keep people attracted to holding on to an office space, and that might be design features that change. It might be fresh air conditioning. It might be figuring out the office plan so social distance is maintained. There might be touchless entry systems put in, all sorts of features that make people feel comfortable about using that office space. But some people, again, might simply withdraw from using office space, and then that raises a whole bunch of other questions.
Yeah, I mean, ergo, we have fewer offices and people are abandoning all this office space. What happens to all those buildings?
Well, we heard earlier from Martin Leitner, he used the phrase blended, the notion that what was once a residential neighborhood could become sort of more blended, a hybridization of uses. And the same could be coming to commercial space. In fact, it already has, in as much as parts of Los Angeles have seen a shift in the zoning. The adaptive reuse ordinance passed 20 years ago transformed the historic district in downtown from commercial to residential. The arts district went from industrial to a mix of industrial and residential. So that we could see that same kind of loosening of the zoning in other commercial areas that could include retail zones. I spoke about this with Vince Bertoni. He's the planning director for the city of Los Angeles. And he pointed out this blurring of zoning has already been underway in the region. But he says that COVID-19 is going to add impetus to loosening that separation of uses.
So what I think that we're going to start seeing is this real change. So for example, you're not going to necessarily have a separation from maybe your apartment and maybe something that is manufacturing something from an industrial standpoint. It may be a very light kind of manufacturing, but I think those barriers are going to have to come down and come down fairly rapidly.
As I say, Vince Bertoni also said that we might see these changes coming to streets that traditionally had a lot of storefronts, retail. Retail has been struggling in recent years. So the implications for our urban fabric are, as you can tell, you know, really immense.
Certainly a lot of changes going forward as these stay-at-home orders are lifted eventually in Los Angeles and throughout California and the nation. How do you feel about them? We'd love to hear from you. Continue to send us your thoughts about what you'd like to see in post-safer-at-home Los Angeles. What can we take from this period and infuse it into a brighter and better LA? KCRW.com/AskGreaterLA, or you can tweet at KCRW using the hashtag GreaterLA. Frances Anderton, what an interesting conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. During these uncertain times, if you're like me, you take comfort in the humor of everyday life, where and when you can find it. For a lot of Angelenos, that includes reading the prose of LA Times columnist Chris Erskine. For decades, he has waxed poetic with books and essays on parenting and suburban life, but Erskine has announced he's leaving the Times. So we'll have to read his unique take on LA life somewhere else. And Chris Erskine joins me now to talk about his decision. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm all right. This is a bit of a scoop. I mean, you've been talking about it, I guess, on Twitter, that you're leaving the LA Times after 30 years.
It just got out there all of a sudden. Somebody who I've known a long time said, hey, you taking the buyout? And it was almost like a whispered kind of tweet. Now, I should know better, right? I'm an adult.
Yeah, there are no whispered tweets, Chris.
There's no whispered tweets. Everything's screaming in social media.
That's right.
Next thing I know, everybody's like, you're really leaving? You're really leaving? The Times offered a buyout in February. And, you know, I'm getting to be that age anyway. I've done it for 30 years. I've done the column for 25. I've been at the LA Times for 30. It just seemed time. This was, you know, before the whole corona thing broke. So that sort of just added to my sense of, you know, you only get one life. It's not a dress rehearsal.
You really found your voice, though, writing about being a father, fatherhood, family. How did you decide to write about such personal topics?
You know, it goes back, Steve, to that old thing, write what you know. And I was in the midst of it. The kids were all in that age, and we had that busy time, you know, in our lives where we just didn't have a moment. And weekends were just crazy and funny and great and rich. And in addition, I was still doing kind of regular editing work at the Times. So I was on weekends hammering out these humor pieces. And I go, what could I write about? Well, it was all right in front of me. You know, we get a hamster and suddenly the hamster's in the wall chewing the wiring. It was just all there. I mean, I was sort of just the stenographer. I mean, I was, they would come up with these lovely arguments and questions and almost like skits. And I would just sit at my office overhearing it sometimes. It was just a, you know, a product of that, of going, I think this is interesting. I don't know that anybody else will, but I think it's interesting. And it wasn't because I thought it was important because I was going through it. It was important because I thought a lot of people were going through it.
One of your most, I guess, well-known columns was about sending your daughter off to college. Talk about a grain of life, right? Would you read a section of that for us?
I will. And this was one of the things I just sort of go, well, you know, everybody goes through it. It's sort of heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. Here it is. You have the tribe and suddenly somebody's leaving. And the first drop off is the hardest. This was our second drop off. Here's a little excerpt from it. Now she's at the ultimate sleepover, an American college. I'll never forget standing outside her unair-conditioned dorm last week, staring up at this four-story cinder block monstrosity, thinking, we've really sent her here? Was she convicted of something? There were box fans in every single window, so many that I feared her dorm might actually lift from the ground, like that house in Up. To keep the building earthbound, we filled it with stuff. Boxes, suitcases, our daughter. And when we finally got everything in, we stalled a while to make sure she was settled. After the third day of this, we decided it was time to say goodbye. By then, I was pretty sure one of us might melt. Turns out I have a heart, for I think I heard it buzzing. Or maybe I inhaled a locust. All I know is that I couldn't speak. So long, baby. It's what everybody goes through. It's what everybody goes through. That drop off, that you know, when you leave the dorm, you know, and you leave your kid behind, it's you know, heart pounding.
You wrote about your kids a lot. I mean, how did they feel about being in your columns?
Well, I used to say they don't know about it. I haven't told them about it yet. But they've always been great sports about it. I think it just is very revealing of their sense of humor and their acceptance of, hey, this is what dad does. And, you know, I didn't write about everything. I mean, I poked most fun I poked at myself. So when I did poke fun at them, it was, you know, sort of out of balance and done from a loving thing, so a loving place. So they've been really good. I mean, we still have things like, you know, weddings coming up and you know, one more college drop-off to go. So there's stuff to come, but there's never been a complaint.
You've also written about personal tragedy in your life, the passing of your son and your wife a couple of years ago. I can't even imagine. Obviously, I'm a pretty insular person, right? Somebody who, you know, kind of keeps the grief inside. How do you exhibit that in a column?
Well, it was therapeutic, frankly, because, you know, I write for a living and I need to sort of, it's personal essay and it's memoir. And this was something that, you know, somebody, one of my editors said, you don't have to write for a while if you don't want to. I go, I kind of have to. This was 2018, and one March day, my son didn't come home from work, and he'd been killed in a traffic accident, and then his mother was undergoing cancer treatment at the time, so it was kind of the 1-2 punch, and then 6 months later, she passed. So yeah, 2018 was, you know, if that didn't break us, kind of what will, right? And even with the COVID-19, you know, we've been through so much worse. So it gives you perspective. Hard times either break you or build you up. And, you know, we've been lucky that we've been able to hold it together.
I know you're not going away. You're going to be continuing to write. Where will we be able to see your columns or your essays going forward?
Well, for now, I can keep writing. The question is, how do I monetize it? I'd like to not be giving it away because people don't respect you. So I'm on Facebook for now. In fact, I'm posting frequently on Facebook these days. So Chris M. Erskine, if you search for that on Facebook, you will find essays and remembrances and all sorts of things. So for now, that's the place to go. And then when I do land someplace, whether it's Medium or some other platform, I will announce it on Facebook. So, you know, I know some people are into Facebook and some people aren't, but it's free and, you know, and it's a good way to follow me. I'm just at the Times through May. It's like a share farewell tour. It just goes on forever and ever. I'll announce Saturday that I'm leaving, and then there'll be a couple columns after that to sort of wrap things up. People will finally say, "We'll just go already, right? So they're like, just get out of here." But anyway, after May, if they look on Facebook and search for me, they'll find me.
It seems like humor is such a big part of your column, but then we're in this really serious time. So when all of this was really starting to take hold, you know, the novel coronavirus, you wrote about how people deal with this kind of anxiety. And I want to end our conversation on that note. Would you mind reading a little bit of that?
Not at all. I just think humor is everything. It's nourishment. And I think, you know, people are finding humor in this. So anyway, here's what I wrote recently on COVID. And sometimes we're not coping so hot. Sometimes we're all just a little bit scared. My buddy Jay confesses to, just before sleep, doing a couple of test swallows and wondering, is that a sore throat? My daughter Rapunzel confesses to, once or twice a day, pausing to take a few deep breaths to test her lungs. When I feel scared, I imagine striking out the 27 Yankees. I pitch Babe Ruth nothing but butterfly changeups and dirty curveballs. I zing him tight on the chin. He laughs a little and flicks the next pitch into the North Atlantic. Jerk. Hey, let's promise not to fret more than we have to. Eventually the doors will swing open. In a couple of months, we'll be dancing at weddings again. And raising a toast to the most amazing thing of all, life.
LA Times columnist Chris Erskine, also author of 3 books, by the way, most recent, Datitude. Chris, my best Godspeed to you. Good luck.
Steve, and to you as well, be safe. Great talking to you.
That's That's all we have time for today, but I got to tell you, KCRW is not immune to the economic disruption that is the new norm, at least the norm for now. The mission, and we do have this mission critical fundraiser going on so we can be there for you in Greater LA, but in order to keep the vital service going, we'd sure appreciate your support. Give what you can afford to and do it for those who cannot give. Yeah, there's a world of hurt right now, an economy that's shaky. At best, today we ask that you give what you can, if you can. And if you can't, don't worry about it. We're here for you, too. KCRW.com/give and do it now. And while you're there, subscribe to the podcast. Share your thoughts with us, too. KCRW.com/GreaterLA. And thank you for your support of KCRW, your daily lifeline. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Mooney, Danielle Chiriguayo, Sonia Geis, Mario Diaz, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Christine Camito, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen each and every day. Thanks to them, and thank you for your ears and your time. Find some beauty today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.